2, 3, 4.
What is the definition of a man?
It's a boy thing.
I think as a man, we do have a lot of responsibilities.
Ah, it's a boy thing.
Someone who works towards being respected.
It's a boy thing.
In today's society, that seems to change.
It's a boy thing.
You can just be whatever you want to be and define that as being a man.
It's a boy thing.
Being a man is being able to show that sad side of you, not just the no emotion side. That's about it.
Bags, what are we doing talking to each other in the holidays?
I'm just sitting here and I have my 12-year-old who's walked into my recording studio, which they see as the free space. But anyway, what are we doing? We're dedicated to our work. That's what we're doing. So we're, you know, holidays, but actually just dedicated to our work. So we're working.
We've had some really great feedback from the last episode, and actually so good that I feel the need simply to read it out verbatim. Now, obviously, last week's podcast was essentially apocalyptic evidence about the poor performance of young men in education, and that's definitely not going to be the tone of the podcast going forward. It's just saying this is the context. So now we want to start talking immediately about what kinds of solutions that we might be able to offer, or that we've explored, or that we implement in our teaching to those challenges, because got to be said, over the years, we can demonstrate that we have had a lot of success with young men in our classes and in our departments. And I think some of the approaches that we've got are really robust and worth sharing. This piece of feedback in particular is from Kirsty Robinson, who is a psychologist, and she listened to the podcast and came back to us with some thoughts that are based in her psychology knowledge. When Gina spoke about a year three who is behind in their literacy, it took me straight back to one of my foundation child and family psychology classes and made me think about the Matthew effect. Bags, we're going to have to find out what the Matthew effect is.
I don't know. We should have already found this out, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, we'll give you a link to the Matthew effect.
Yeah.
Which got me to wondering, how do you try to close the expanding gap when you get a year nine arriving with very poor literacy and little interest in English? Especially when you take into account the developmental changes typically occurring at this age, where the opinion of peers matters so much. Does it, therefore, potentially take more than interest to get them engaging in something they're not good at, particularly as doing this also carries the risk of negative social evaluations by peers if they give it a go and get it wrong? That's the first part of her feedback. And it's totally on the button, isn't it? By the time they're in year nine, the people that they're trying to impress, the people who are their audience, are typically each other rather than their teachers or even their parents. And therefore, how do you create a situation if they're not strong in an area where they're going to take risks, isn't it, in order to learn?
I did think a lot about this after reading her comment, because it made me think about my own practice. How do we make a difference when we have those students who are so far behind coming into year nine in our schools, and then we're not trying to catch them up. Sometimes that's not possible. Even if the difference is that they start to love the learning and they trust the person that they're working with.
I think loving the learning is core to it. And I think the path towards achieving that is on a relational basis.
Yes.
I think a red herring that a lot of teachers may find themselves following is the idea that they would love the learning by loving the content.
Yeah.
And I'm probably going to speak against the idea that you adapt the content to the needs of the lower achievers, because I feel like that I understand the motive, and the motive is about engaging them, but I feel like it's a misapprehension of what engages people.
So we're talking about possibly having the high expectations, or we're talking about having differentiation, or are we talking about dumbing it down? Can I just get you to clarify that bit?
I definitely agree, don't dumb it down.
Yeah.
But I do also agree that you need to provide points of access. But I think the red herring that I think I'm trying to articulate is more, I wouldn't start with any of that. My thinking doesn't start there. My thinking starts more culturally. So before I start thinking about what I put in front of them and the kinds of challenges that I ask them to tackle, I'm first wanting to think about the kind of culture that I want to establish in the classroom. And I have to say, I think the first months of teaching a year nine class are more about establishing culture and routines
yes.
than they necessarily always are about particular content.
Yes.
And so it's about building a rapport and a relationship, which I think is the core of all of this. So establishing the teacher-student relationship and the yes. student-student relationship and the expectations of the classroom, not through constant statements thereof, but actually through practicing those things. And also I think creating a lot of really clearly articulated protocols around, for example, making mistakes. So celebrating errors
yeah.
and
yeah.
exploring how every error is an opportunity to learn and making yes. that real,
yes.
like with a year nine student, you know, a 12 or 13 year old, not just saying that as a theory and then possibly, as I've often seen, acting against that by yeah. immediately marking something and giving them a low mark and then saying you've got, you know, that's an opportunity to learn, which actually it's just an opportunity to fail.
Yes.
I think it's about building games and exercises into the classroom where the goal is to push yourself to the point where you fail, and then when the failure occurs, celebrating that.
Yeah.
Like, yes, you've reached a point where you now have something to learn. So some of the things that allow for that to happen are actually taking the scaffolds away. Like, we'll use that exam.net platform and make sure that they write without spell check, and then we'll have some fun at exploring how many of the words are wrong, and not make them compete to have the most amount wrong, but certainly certainly center the number that are wrong and to grow our understanding of how those mistakes were made as the purpose of the learning, so that the people who have got something to offer that conversation are the contributors.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. I mean, there's actually some complex psychology behind this, but it's essentially starting to elevate the learning from mistakes in the classroom culture as being the most important thing we do before we start looking at having to cover particular content or meet specific outcomes, so that young people are kind of encouraged to make mistakes and also to share that they are making mistakes and to become curious about how to fix those things.
I have been saying a lot to my year nine class, the best place that you learn, and I say it to my kids at home as well, is through failure. So they've been conditioned, I think, to think that they can't fail. I have been saying that to my year nine boys, this is where you're going to learn the most. And when we talk about building that culture within the classroom, but the great thing about my year nine boys is that I have photos of them all coming up to the whiteboard and writing the things that they've found in the artist models up on the board. We discuss the mistakes that they're making in their work. One example was I have this one boy who wants to write, be the teacher and write the thing. So I just stand at the back of the room while he amends the things that people have done. However, he got a homophone wrong. And that was just a beautiful moment when I went, homophone, who knows what a homophone is? And then they corrected him, but it wasn't done in a way that there was deep shame for him. Mm-hmm. It was that we were all kind of learning. It's okay to make mistakes. I didn't even need to say that to them.
It's that culture where we're all striving for excellence, but also very clear that the path involves a whole lot of missteps, and that it's interrogating those missteps that's part of that makes the learning meaningful. I mean, I felt one of the most wonderful moments I've had so far this year was with a group of students in a year 12 class who have been through a bit of this with us and have worked in the ways that you're describing. And then they've come through to year 12 and I wrote something on the board and I missed an apostrophe. I made some kind of mistake. And it wasn't intentional. It was a genuine mistake. And the students' enthusiastic identification of that mistake and the laughter that we had about the mistake and them kind of reflecting on the fact that this is part of the culture of learning in English, that these mistakes are always addressed, including my mistakes.
Yes.
And obviously modeling making mistakes and learning from them. Like, that moment is really important. Like, I really had to not claim it was an intentional error. It was very important that they could see that I live by that philosophy of learning from your mistakes, and also by the philosophy of showing grace in response to making errors. So how do I respond to having made an error?
You don't get defensive.
No, you can't be defensive. You have to accept your mistake, and you have to love the fact that they've shared that with you and treat it as if they've given you a gift. It's been a positive thing, a desirable thing that they would pick you up on that.
You've often said to me that we need to learn alongside the students. This is highlighting that. And of course, it's that whole thing of having vulnerabilities like they do that makes you a successful role model, because we're not perfect. There are times when I go to write a word on the board and I go to the students, does it have this letter in it? I need to check that. I'm not a walking dictionary like you, Chris. So I'll check that out, and I don't make a big fuss over that. And sometimes they'll go, oh, no, it's got this. And I remember last year at Queen's, even though I know this is a boys' podcast, but last year at Queen's I had written a word incorrectly, and we were doing spelling and stuff. And then I said that they'd spelt it wrong, they'd spelt it right. And then when they pulled me on it a few weeks later, I went, no, I stuffed up. Yeah, no, I did. I did. But it was okay. They didn't look at me like I failed them through that. It's that whole idea of integrity, isn't it? You know, like you're honouring yourself.
Yeah.
You're honouring the things that you say must happen, therefore you have integrity too.
And I think acknowledging our own fallibility is a big, important message to them about what we're saying about their fallibility, is that we need to be able and be large enough in ourselves to accept that we will make mistakes, and sometimes we'll find it embarrassing, but it's all survivable. I must admit, I do patrol the classroom for their undermining each other, and I don't really have any tolerance for that. Like, I will always act on anything that I consider might be a means of undermining another student, and I'll do it in a way where I suggest that they might not have understood that what they were doing was undermining another person. I'm not going to attack their intentions. I'm just going to say, often when you do that, when someone's giving an answer, it can undermine them. And so that you're agreeing that no one wants to do that, but also at the same time, I make it my responsibility to try to ensure that it doesn't happen. Let's read on from the feedback from Kirsty. So we've had one paragraph. Here's the next paragraph of feedback. She said, "This also got me thinking about sex-based differences in development, acknowledging that there are population-level differences and each individual have their own trajectory. The research suggests that the limbic system develops earlier in boys than girls, whereas the reverse is true for the prefrontal cortex. This asynchronous development means that boys are typically operating from more of an emotional brain in early adolescence. They are incredibly responsive to social cues and rewards, and the importance of relationship is through the roof. So she's asking us, how do we take this into account when trying to close the gap or get boys interested in succeeding?" She asks, "What does this mean if English is seen as uncool or even a girl's subject? And what does it mean to try and fail in English at these ages?" This also speaks to the point you make, or we make, she says, about role models and how male success is portrayed in the media and positive representations of what it means to be male. So she's just posing a number of different points of view there. And I think one of the things our school does really well, and I think is one of the keys to its success, is that it does position a lot of young men succeeding in lots of different ways into really high profile places. And so there's lots of forms of success in young men shown to the younger students, and a lot of comfort around seeing each other succeed, a kind of real reaffirmation of each other's success. So on the success side of things, I think our school does brilliant work at uplifting young men.
Yeah, Otago Boys does a similar thing. I actually really like reading the newsletters because they have a final word from the different prefects, and the prefects, of course, have multiple strengths. And one of the boys actually was one of my learners from a year 13 class, and it was really nice reading what he was, so much humility, the way he spoke about himself and that he's not perfect, and but all the things that he has achieved, but his encouragement to obviously the school population and what they can do. And I thought that that was nice. So again, yes, lots of success in the boys, and that's publicised widely so that the boys can see that they can reach these things, that they can obtain them as well.
So this is, I think, one of the things that probably boys' schools typically do well, and that's celebrating a diverse array of different ways for boys to be successful. The diverse array of measures of success are almost inherently likely to be true, because if it's going to happen, it's going to be done by a boy. And so there's no form of educational engagement or social engagement in schools or the wider life of the school that isn't led by a boy. And that allows there to be an abundance of diverse, really positive role models. I'm thinking also, though, back to the teacher modeling thing.
I was going to say females versus males.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really important that both of us acknowledge that your gender is not a precursor to your success as a teacher with boys, and that boys don't need their teachers to be male to take them seriously.
No.
At all.
But I do think. You're going to say but. Yes.
I do think there's a but. I think it's important that teachers who work with boys acknowledge them as boys and are positive about boys. Yeah. And it doesn't. That's not a male thing. It doesn't take a male to do that. But I sometimes consider that to be a challenge in education at large, because I think there is an element there of pathologizing boy behavior.
I've been sitting there thinking about one of my boys that I have that has presented challenges this term. And probably the most challenges are presented to myself and another female colleague who have quite static subjects. I do get the boys in my class up and moving and doing things, but yep. not like you would within a laboratory for science, or of course not PE or whatever. And of course the boys are needing to learn at times that they do have to sit still and manage their wriggling and all those things. But it was really fascinating then seeing this boy go and interact with the science teacher who is a male and was sitting there smiling. I'm not getting the smiles yet.
Yeah.
And I sat there observing it going, okay, part of what I'm experiencing, I believe, is because I'm a woman. Yeah. Now, I'm a strong woman. You know this about me, which a lot of boys can relate to. But at the same time, I thought, my goodness, I guess when you're a strong female and you're trying to assert behaviors, rules, expectations, learning outcomes with boys based on their perception of you as a woman, maybe you might just be seen as the nag. You may be seen as a word that starts with B, you know, all those sorts of things. So I've had a few staff, in terms of the students at school, question, is it because you're a female? My response often is no, it's because I have high expectation.
It would be unacceptable for me to pretend that young men treat female teachers the same as they treat male teachers, because they just don't. When you think about what Kirsty just shared with us in her last paragraph, yes. about how boys are more strongly emotionally sensitive and motivated, I don't know if I would always think that all my colleagues as teachers would immediately share that they understood that. I think that sometimes girls are characterized as having more emotions and as being more emotionally driven, whereas according to this, it's actually the other way around. And I feel like that while boys don't necessarily articulate their emotions in the same way as you might expect from girls, that doesn't mean they're not having them. And I feel like if you're not acknowledging the fact that there's a lot of emotions going on underneath there, then you can sort of read behavior in a way that might not be an accurate reading of the behavior. Well, yeah. This is another neurobiological insight. So this is from Kirsty again, but she's quoting someone else, Abigail Norfleet Jones. Positive student-teacher relationships predict positive attitudes towards school. An earlier limbic development, e.g. the amygdala in boys, means they need positive feeling from their teacher more than girls. They require a social atmosphere that's responsive to social goals. Boys will handicap themselves in class if there's a social cost to certain actions. Boys will work hard for teachers they like, and if they don't have a connection with their teacher, they report boredom and anger, which is a limbic response. Especially where there are perceptions of injustice or unfairness.
Can I ask you a question? You're very successful in your classroom management and very successful teaching both boys and girls. But what do you think that you do, apart from the stuff that you talked about earlier? Like, you talked about building the relationships, but can you give some more grounded, specific examples that actually show how you would hook them in? Does that make sense to you? Because I think you've talked in a kind of broad way, but if you've got a tricky customer, and you and I both know you've had tricky customers, just like I have, how do you get them on board with you? Because kids love you. Like, this is the thing about you, Chris, and I'm saying it to the listeners. Kids love Chris. So how do you, like, what do you do?
Well, it's quite funny that you observe that about the students, because my immediate reaction to what you were saying, even before you said it, was that the first thing I do is love the kids. Like, before I start anything, I won't walk into a classroom and not first engage with my sense of genuine love for the young people I work with. And they know it. They know I love being with them and the work that we do. And they know I love my subject. So I start by being genuine, vulnerable, and authentic. And I don't necessarily say I love you in the first sentence that I meet students, but
you say that towards the end of the year.
But they do get to hear it. It is actually a truth for me. But they get to experience it. And so if I'm thinking about how you as a teacher love a student, if you love someone, then you're genuinely going to have a belief in their good intentions. So I always believe that young people are motivated by something good. It doesn't necessarily mean that the thing that they're presenting us with is a good thing or a helpful thing, but I have a belief in the fact that it's coming from a good place of some kind, whether it's a cry for help or whether it's a bad habit or whether it's a ill-judged moment. And essentially, I'll simplify it. I never ascribe intention to the behavior. So if someone's doing something that's hurtful or harmful or damaging or self-destructive and all of the things we're trying to minimize, then I'll never ever assume that they're intentionally trying to hurt or harm. It's more that's the solution they have right now to the situation they're in. And I think that my role is to give them a better option, is to offer them better ways to respond to what they're experiencing in that moment. So I think that perhaps students genuinely believe that I'm there to look after their interests, like it's a proper authentic belief that they have. And then I think that I'm become useful to them by offering them alternate ways to the ways that they're behaving. I haven't really encountered a student who actually wants to harm his peers or wants to abuse me as a teacher or wants to avoid all work. That's not a core desire. That's just a behavior that's manifest itself because of a number of things. And I think setting up really clear routines and giving strong advice about how alternate ways to act can lead to them realizing that you're working to their benefit. It's not pandering to them. It's not giving in to all the things they say and do. It's actually genuinely acknowledging that quite often the things they say and do are not in their interests, and that I have some experience and some ability to support them to be better.
For those people who are listening, and possibly they've had feedback in practicums or student voice that they could work on relationships more, how do you get it if you don't got it? Students see through the bullshit, don't they?
They
see people who aren't being authentic. So I guess it's what are some of the things that we're looking at if we can raise boys' achievement through giving them practitioners that are A, B, and C, whatever A, B, and C is, but what are some of the tools that they can employ?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that most of the teachers that I have ever met come from a place of love. Like they really do both love the job and their students, and they're very highly invested in seeing them succeed. So I don't think there's anything peculiar about that for me, although I might express it in quite black and white terms. I know it's absolutely true for you as well. And I know that the times when a teacher questions themselves, it's often when you're feeling the loss of that feeling. Like that's the time when you actually wonder whether you can continue in the work. So it's a precursor for us all, I think. When it comes to your kind of question, how do you do it? I actually feel like you already almost answered it, because you talked in terms of authenticity. Yeah. You talked in terms of the fact that you can't kind of fake the things that are true for you in front of a group of students. They will actually, they'll perceive it immediately. It's super important that you're doing what is natural and right for you, that you're operating consistently with your own values and your own nature and the relationship you currently have. I know if you just sent the graduated teacher out into the school environment and said, be open-hearted and authentic, and then said, go for it. Like they'd last 3 days, wouldn't they? So it's definitely not the end of the story, but it's the underpinning to all the other success. I mean, I think another thing that teaching does to you is it forces you to face yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm also thinking about when I went for a job interview and somebody said to me, how do you publicise English within the school? How do you build its reputation? And I said, by being good at what you do.
Mm.
And that then links into a lot of people obviously are really hot on Russell Bishop's work at the moment. But of course, if you want to be sitting in that Northeast category, not only do you have to have strong relationships with students, but you have to know your subject area.
Yeah.
And knowing your subject area also means loving it, like what you've talked about.
Mm.
That's so important. You just can't go through the motions,
yeah.
Which is sort of also what you've been linking into that whole thing of when you start questioning yourself and your relation, you know.
I would definitely go so far as to say if you don't actually love students or you don't love your subject, yeah. then please find another job. Like go and do something that you do love. Life's too short and this job is too hard to be even contemplating trying to do it if it didn't actually light your fire. I think what would be good for our next podcast, let's announce it now, is that in a couple of weeks' time, we'll come back to you and we'll be posing specific classroom scenarios and options as to how to respond to those and see what we come to with that. Well, Bags, lovely to talk to you in the holidays, but I think I need to let you get back to your kids who are battening down the doors to get to you.
Somebody's going. Yeah, here they go again. Someone's about to come in the door, you know.
Fascinated.
Yeah, look. Oh, yeah. Hi, Avery. So that's Avery. Yeah, bub. Anyway, okay. Nice talking to you as always.
I love Avery's invented language.
Yeah.
You have children who are designed to challenge you. One has decided to make up a language.
Oh, you know, you go to a pediatrician, you get told he's going to be gifted. He's highly intelligent. Well, it doesn't help. And do you want any tools to deal with that child? No.
You'll know, but it is interesting, isn't it? The parents that I know of students who fit into that category, it's hard yards.
Oh yeah, it's not easy. I have aged seriously like 10 years in the last nearly 3 years anyway.
Wow. Oh. Man, can't wait to hear what he says when he comes around to English.
I know. Well, he's heard a lot of expletives, so who knows?
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. See you.
It's a Boy Thing, a fortnightly chat about teaching English to boys with Gina and Chris.
I think being a man is having good friendships and strong relationships with the people around you.